I ask you to please help me welcome Charlie C. from Camarillo.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Nate for inviting me to. Is Nate here?
No, he's not.
Okay, let him know I kept my end up. Thank Cora for texting me yesterday and letting me know that I'm still supposed to be here, and always good to see Lee. If Lee's going to be here, I know it's going to be, I'll be fine. But and congratulations to the people who took chips. I'm always happy to see the guy, the newest guy in the room, follow Leo's direction perfectly while the other two don't. That always makes it. You're going to make it, Cody. You got this. As long as you can follow direction, you're going to be fine. I'm an alcoholic. I haven't got any outside issues. I know it's terrible. I know this is an AA meeting, but I'm afraid tonight I'm just going to talk about alcoholism. I'm sober since the 11th of June of 1981. It's my only sobriety date. I haven't been through rehab. I got sober the old-fashioned way at work, and I haven't been arrested, haven't totaled a car. Well, I guess if you accumulate all the accidents together, it sort of adds up to a total, but you know, you drag it down a stucco wall or you're backing up, you know, sometimes you're getting too close to the center divider and you don't know it until the door you've left open slammed shut while you're driving. That's happened. I came out of a blackout one time with, it was about 1972. I was on the 55 freeway in Orange County, and I was in my old Volkswagen, just a beat up old Volkswagen. And I was driving and I was pulling on the steering wheel as hard as I could toward the window, as hard as I could. And the guy who was in the car with me, who I'd been drunk with, who I worked with, had the other side of the steering wheel, and he was pulling it as hard as he could the other direction. And we were both laughing when I came out of the blackout. And as we tore along the freeway at about 70 miles an hour, I said, we both have to let go of this at the same time. You know, there's going to be a disaster, which it was okay. We let go of it at the same time. So I couldn't have been that drunk. But I'm just an alcoholic. I don't have any spectacular news for you. I got here on somebody else's power. I was brought here by someone, but that's a little later, I think. I meander a little bit because I don't care. My story is you can take it in pieces, you can take it chronologically. It really doesn't make any difference. You'll go home tonight, you'll forget who spoke here in 10 minutes, but... my parents, I'm an only child. My dad was a Marine Corps drill instructor. My mom was a housewife in the 1950s. And I grew up, we didn't have a lot of resources, but I had everything I needed, but certainly not everything I wanted. Life has always been a big disappointment to me. Everything is a disappointment. Because I have expectations on life. Why shouldn't I? You know, you go through 9 months of gestation and growing up, and you're pushed into the world, and shouldn't you have some expectations that are met? I don't know. I thought so. And that's how I grew up, is having expectations that I couldn't tell my parents about because they'd lived through the Depression. My dad had been through World War II, and they weren't particularly interested in my feelings about anything. And I went through school. I had what my friend Don Gates used to say was that he was crucified on the cross of potential, and I had lots of potential when I was growing up. I get brought into offices of teachers and priests and administrators and counselors, and they would go, "Charles has potential." To my parents, they would say this. My parents, who neither of them graduated the middle school, my dad quit school in the fifth grade, my mom quit school in the seventh grade, and they said, "Charles has a lot of potential," and they had that glimmer of hope. before he said, we just don't understand why he doesn't do anything with it. My reaction to that, because it wasn't the first time I'd been brought in like that, was always, I know I've got potential. Clearly, you know I've got potential. Now my parents know I've got potential. I really appreciate that. And I just want you to know I will use my potential when I'm goddamn good and ready to use it. And not even that much sooner. And when I do use it, I hope you've got sunglasses on, Scooter, because I'm going to light you up. But until that happens, you might want to take your absurd concern for my potential and go wipe it on some other sap, because if you were such hot stuff, you wouldn't be a high school counselor, would you? It never came out in exactly those words. I usually said, I'll try harder. But I always meant those words. I'm a secret rebel. I don't know if that makes any sense. I just don't tell. I'm a rebel. I don't tell anybody. I'll run for help if it looks like you need it, but I'm not. I follow the rebels, you know. I like rebels. And some people actually said what I was thinking, and you're the ones who did time. I just kept it to myself and suffered. But I got out of high school with no notoriety at all except for my potential, and went right into the music industry. I was a clerk in a record store. I was working there, and these guys came in from my high school that I'd known vaguely. They were sort of, when I was in high school, I wasn't really a joiner, because I don't like people, pretty much. Not you. You know who I'm talking about. They're, people are self-absorbed little idiots, and a frightful waste of carbon, as far as I'm concerned. If the whole species evaporated tomorrow, I wouldn't care. I just find them that way. But the problem I have with them is I need their approval all the time. And it's exhausting to loathe this whole group of people and have them need their approval. But I give it a go every morning. And so I didn't want to go to this party. I'd never been to a party. I was 18 at that point. I just turned 18. It was November of 1968, and I didn't want to go to the party, because I assumed at a party there would be other people, right? I mean, that's an assumption you would make. I hadn't been there, but I assumed there would be others. And I just couldn't bring myself to go and put myself through that stuff. So I said, okay. And I wound up going to the party with my buddy, and it was exactly what I thought it was. It was like 250 teenagers and a big Victorian house in Santa Ana, half of them drunk, half on acid, most of them dancing around like they thought Neil Young was going to show up at some point, and, you know, waving their fringe around, and it was just hideous. And just the thought of it now makes me, my gag reflex kick in a little bit. They thought they were hippies, but they were Sears hippies. They're the ones that didn't become hippies until the clothes became available at Sears. And then all of a sudden they were, you know, decked out to be hippies. They're the same people that got into disco later. But I got there, I was in there 5 minutes thinking, this is like listening to philosophy 101 coming out of the mouth of people who've never experienced anything in their life before. I can't stand it in here. I got to get out of here. My friend was the one who drove, and he was a drummer in a rock band. I thought maybe I'd catch some of the, you know, the overflow of the girls that were after him. And I just stood there, and it was just dreary. And I couldn't very much very well go up and ask him to leave, because we'd only been there for 5 minutes. So I had to stand there and tolerate it. And somebody walked by with a can of malt liquor, and they said, here, it's the people's beer, you know. I thought, oh, great. And I got a can of malt liquor, and the first thing on my mind is, if my dad knows I've got a can of malt liquor and I'm around these people, he's going to kill me. Second thought was, if the archbishop, I love dogs, but the crawl space under my house is full. He hands me this can of malt liquor, and I'm thinking, if the archbishop of the Archdiocese of Orange County finds out I've got this can of malt liquor, he's going to excommunicate me from the Catholic Church. But no one was offering me anything else. So after about 5 minutes of looking at this can in my hand, I popped it open and drank about half of it. And it occurred to me at that point, at the halfway mark, that I'd been way too hard on you people. I began to feel connected. I began to feel better. I began to feel a sense of anticipation that I'd never experienced before about life. I felt happy. I felt connected. I felt attractive. Like, ladies, my eyes are up here attractive. That kind of attractive. And I felt like you were fascinating. Fascinating people. I could have listened to you all night. And, well, not really, but that's how I felt, sort of. And I'd never experienced that before, ever. And it occurred to me then that if a little bit of alcohol could change my entire way I looked at the world and make me feel connected in here and not feel all that conflict from all those miserable, ferret-faced little bastards out there, that maybe life would be better. I mean, it seems like everybody else gets it, and I need a little jump start. I need to kind of get some lubrication there. So a couple of drinks makes me feel like I'm ready to go. I'm happy, I'm connected, I'm interested in life. And I found something else. I'll jump ahead a little bit. After I got sober, I became a teacher. I went back to grad school. I became a teacher, taught for several years, became a professional writer. While I was working on a project about 10 years ago, I needed to look up the velocity of a bullet coming out of a handgun in 1932. Okay, just trust me on this. Don't you have to remember that? But I know, because I know people are going to come up to me, and when I say it came, when I found out, I did the research, and bullet comes out of the barrel of a 1932 handgun at 850 feet FPS, which is feet per second. I know someone's going to come up to me later and say, well, it's up to 1400 now, Charlie. Keep it to yourself. Anyway, when I found that out, I couldn't believe it. I thought, 850 feet per second, that's a wallop. That's fast. You know, but if you take that gun and you shoot it into a body of water, it comes out of the barrel 850 feet per second, just burning hot, hits the surface of the water, keeps going. If you've seen any underwater photography of bullets going into water, zzz, into the water, keeps going 850 feet, 450, 250, 150, 20, to the bottom. Such is the trajectory of my life. I come out of any project, relationship, new job, connection, life, I come out of the barrel at 850 feet per second, burning hot. I am into it. I am into it. This is going to be the best thing that ever happened to me, and probably to you too, if we're together on this. And I'm so full of joy with it, but then I hit the surface of the water, and I keep going, you know, I keep going 850 feet per second. I'm fine. This is going to be great. This is going to be, and then I just drift harmlessly to the bottom of whatever the body of water is. And the water is fear. And I have been living in a soup of fear my entire life. It never goes away. Never leaves it, and I never am conscious of it when I'm in it. You know, I have to have somebody else tell me, you're afraid. Because I don't get it. I'm not afraid. I'm just not interested. I'm not afraid. I just am not that attracted to it. I'm not afraid. I just didn't want that job. You know, I didn't want to try this. I'm not afraid. And fear has guided my life. I don't know what caused it. It doesn't matter what causes it. Anything that I have in my life that may have caused the way I felt when I was growing up, or the way I even feel tonight, has nothing to do with anything. It doesn't have anything to do with my alcoholism. But fear has always kept my feet glued to the floor with anything. Because I'll be in relationships. I've been married three times. So the season of giving really doesn't appeal to me that much, but and there's only a very, I wore this tie because it's a very small window for this. I wore it for Lee. There's only a two-hour window to wear this tie in any given season. So anyway, but my mom had four babies, and I was the only one who lived. The others all died at birth, all boys. And I never thought much about that. I never thought about how my mother suffered for that, what grief she must have experienced at the loss of those babies. But I know that the fourth one was after my birth, and I was sent down to the neighbor's house. I was about 7 years old, seven or eight. I got sent down to the neighbor's house, and my mom went into the hospital for this baby. And I remember the night that I was sleeping in this Chris Klein's bedroom, the spare bed they had in there. I was laying on my side facing the wall and drawing an infinity sign in the wall, on the wall. And I said, God, please help my mom and please help this baby be okay. Please let it be okay. Thank you. And the next day, you can go home now, but just don't talk to your mom about babies. Okay, if just remember that. And I went home, and there were cards stuck in the screen door, and there was food left on the front porch and things, and no one talked about anything. They didn't talk about anything. No one talked about babies. No one talked about my mom. She came home, and no one said a word. And it took me 27 years to figure out or find out what happened that day. But what I realized from that very day was that I did not trust any power that claimed to be God. That charade is over. I did my first communion. I did all that stuff. But I sure don't believe in God. I believe there is a God. I just don't believe he has anything to do with me. Because if he did, why didn't he answer my prayer when everybody talks about how wonderful God is? He's just a wonderful person. I had prayed for my uncle, and my uncle lived. You know, well, what if your uncle died? Do you still think he's great? You know, is he still making you happy? I was really angry, and I didn't realize how much I was angry at that. I still get angry about God sometimes. You know, the fact that George Harrison and Tom Petty are dead, and Michael Bolton is still singing. I mean... But I still, I just, I did not like this idea of a higher power at all. And I play, the thing is, you play along. You just play along. Go along to get along. Okay? And we can break into discussion groups later. Are you texting while I'm talking? Honest to God? I drove 2 hours to watch you, he said with love. I don't know who that was, but anyway. This is an AA meeting. This is a Starbucks. So now I got to start all over again. I'm Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't have any interest in knowing this power because it apparently only cared about the people that it cared about, the good people. And you know who they are. They're the ones that put gloves in their glove box, those kind of people. The ones that pour with a shot glass that has a 1 ounce mark on it. You know, those people just tick you off. And when you go someplace and there's a shot glass and it's got that ounce mark, and you can see them going like this to see that the level doesn't go above the come on, just free pour it. Give us a break. Because I like drinking at bars. That's my favorite place to drink until someone wants a conversation. But I enjoy sitting amongst the astronauts and physicists and surgeons that go to the bars I used to go to, like the Humdinger in Anaheim. But I just didn't care about a higher power at all. I stopped going to church. I hated this God. I didn't hate him. It wasn't that dramatic. I just didn't have any interest in it at all. I thought it was a fiction. It's a big fiction. If you believe in it, great. If God brings down the swelling that you prayed for, that's fine. I'm happy for you. But I haven't got any interest in him because I can figure this stuff out myself. I wasn't born yesterday, you know. At least I wasn't born late yesterday. And And so I went through life like that, thinking that I had control over things. But I got a taste of alcohol, and I just thought, there's nothing else I would rather do. Alcohol gives me the satisfaction of a job well done without having to do a damn thing. It makes me feel so good. Why mess up my buzz? Alcohol makes me feel connected to the world in a way I never felt before. So why would you suggest that I stop doing it? You know, that just seems, because I can't stop once I start, but why would I ever want to stop? Once I start drinking, I feel so good that I've got to keep going, and I don't know how to stop. I just continue to go, and then the next day I get sick, and I wake up sick, or what, you know how you wake up the next day, like someone had been breeding seals in your mouth, and I wake up, and I'd shake, and I'd be sick, and then I'd go for the hangover, keep getting worse and worse, and I'd say, I'm never going to do that again, I'm not going to do that again, not on a work night, I'm not going to do that again, and then it gets worse and worse, and then it finally reaches that point where it goes from 1%, it's 1% better than it was the moment before, and I think, well, I'm better now, I'm fine, you know, I can drink again. Let's take, this time I'm going to do it smarter, though. I'm just going to take a couple of drinks, level everything out. My drinking never got any better. I just drink the same way. I just drink. That's all I do. I tried taking drugs. I don't care about drugs. Drugs don't, you know, when I drink, I get there when I drink. I don't get high. I don't want to be high. I want to be there. And if you're alcoholic, you know where there is. Because that's where we're all going. Well, your there may not look like mine, but we know where we're going. You know? I don't want to be loaded. You know, wind up an hour, you know, smoking pot till 3 a.m. and then wind up in the kitchen eating ketchup packets out of the refrigerator. What kind of a lame habit is that? I ate a bouillon cube one night because it tasted like chicken that was crunchy. You know, that kind of stupid. Hey, let's smoke a bong. No, I don't want to smoke. I want to get there. I don't want to take amphetamines like I did for a year and wind up, you know, with my eyes trying to beat me into the next room. That's not my thing. And I don't want to, that's not for me. I want to, and when I'm there, I'm not drunk. Other people mistake it for drunk, but I'm not. If a cop pulled me over, I tell him straight up, I'm not drunk, I'm there. I'm there. I'm at that place that is way better because I'm not my normal self, which is a brittle dick. And the other side is a slobbery, wobbly-legged drunk. I'm not there. I'm there. And I'd be having the cuffs on me in no time. But so that's how I drank for 12 years. Never got any better. It got worse, physically worse, mentally worse, spiritually worse. Until I couldn't do anything that I couldn't see the benefit for me in it, you know? And I would try to, we have a knack, I can't even really describe it. We got a knack of being able to treat somebody, and the Al-Anons will get this, we treat somebody a certain way until they back up and back up, and we keep treating them that way and back up, and then finally they can't take it anymore and they walk away, and I get to feel like a victim. Well, just walked away from me. Just when I was going to start becoming a better person, you walked out, you know? And that's how I always treated things, to protect myself. Fear of the honest assessment of what's going on with me. I couldn't tell the truth. You know, I went to therapy for a couple of years with the encouragement of my first wife. And I went to therapy for 2 years. It wasn't going well because therapy is a really good thing. It's a great thing for people, but it doesn't work for alcoholism. It just doesn't, because the prerequisite for therapy working is the truth. And if you're an alcoholic, I hate to say it, you know, you and I, we don't have a whiff of the truth early on. We finally start getting a whiff of it when we start having to do certain things in here. And but I didn't. And I started college when I was 17. I thought I was a prodigy. I graduated at 30. And I was never anything that I thought I was. I always thought I was better than I was. There's an effect. There's a psychological effect that the scientists have come up with called the Dunning-Kruger effect. That is a misperception that people have these days that they are much better at what they do than what they really are. The people believe they really are, because people have been pumping up their resumes. I've certainly pumped mine up. And then you find out that you really aren't that good. But it's hard to believe that. So if you're like me, you try to clear the bar and you can't clear it, so you raise the bar. You know, next time I would take 12 units of college. I'm gonna do 12 units and work full time. And I sign up for college. And I get in there and I would drop out of all my classes within 2 months and go, what did I just do? Did it again. So the next semester I'd sign up for 15 units. Because this time I'm gonna really do it this time. And you know the story. And that's how I was living my life. I didn't have to, as long as I could perceive something better in my mind, I didn't have to do it in my life. And my wife wanted a divorce, and I was really destroyed by that, because I thought I loved her, but I didn't love her enough to change. And her only flaw was she really loved me and thought she could help me change. Her brother, I just drove past Lake Kachuma on the way up here. And my wife's brother, I met him for the first time when he came over to our apartment. And she said, you know, Bob, she told me this beforehand, Bob's been in several rehabs and not rehabs, they didn't have any rehabs then, really, not many of them in 1980. This was 75. They didn't have any rehabs. They did have like spin drives where they bring you in there and they wouldn't let you drink until you were sober, and then they kind of push you back out in the street, or they'd send you to a sanitarium where they would cater to your needs until you were capable of drinking like a gentleman. And so Bob had been to several of those places, and so she said, be careful, don't drink tonight. You know, because she knew how I was. It was pretty obvious how I was. And so I said, well, yeah, I'm not gonna, you know, I get it. And so Bob came over, and what a great guy. Well, this guy had never been in a sanitarium. But look at him. He's handsome. He's friendly. I got out a bottle of bourbon, and we started drinking, and we were having a great time listening to records and hanging out. I glance over, and she's standing at the bedroom door giving me this signal, which is the international sign if you're a man. This is the international sign that you're not going to get a compliment. And I excused myself, and I walked into the bedroom, and she shut the door, and she said, she had tears in her eyes, she said, stop giving Bob alcohol. Bob is an alcoholic. And I teetered back on my heels and said, Bob is no more of an alcoholic than I am. The problem we have here is that you are a nag, and maybe you ought to back it off a notch, sister. And I turned around and strutted out of that bedroom, you know, and she started crying. I mean, she was really sobbing in there, so we had to turn up the stereo. And the sad part of this whole story is that 2 weeks later, Bob was dead. He drowned in Lake Kachuma. He came up here with some friends. He took some pills. He drank, and he went into the water. Never came out. He had a 5-year-old daughter and an estranged wife, and no one talked about alcoholism. I had to come up and get his car and all those things, and no one brought up. No one talked about drinking. It was kind of real quiet all of a sudden. You know, and so I started going to therapy because she suggested it, and I thought it would keep the peace in the house. And I went to a therapist who was like, I thought I could pull the wool over her eyes, and she was sharp. I didn't think she was going to be that sharp, because I'm usually pretty good at you know, manipulating people, and not really. I can't pull it off, but I always marry people who can. So I went to therapy, and she was having a meditation retreat in Montecito, and I went to that retreat, and it was June the 11th of 1981, and I hadn't had anything to drink that day. I'd embarrassed myself the night before in front of a bunch of teenagers at a McDonald's, humiliated myself. Don't remember exactly what happened, but remember the feeling of it and the embarrassment and the shame. And I go up to this meditation retreat, and now I've got to act like I've got it all together because my therapist is going to be there, you know. So I go up there with bright, shiny, glowing red face and twitching because I'd started detoxing. And I went up there, I pull in, and I'm the first person there as the other people are pulling in behind me and around me. And I walk right up to the main house, and she had told me this before. She said, don't ever come to a therapy session smelling of alcohol, or else I will not treat you anymore, period. Okay, so I can drink afterward. And which is what, you know, I'm sure everybody in here was way ahead of me on that one. But so I go up to the main room, and she said, she was so happy to see me. She said, can I get you something to drink? And I thought, this is great. I said, sure, I'll have a glass of Burgundy. And she laughed, and she said, no, we don't have any alcohol up here or wine. And my first thought was, we are in a Catholic retreat center. Certainly there is some unconsecrated blood of Christ around here somewhere. Find it. I didn't say that to her. I just went, oh. And she said, can I get you some tea? And I thought, well, nothing makes me feel better when I'm about to come down off of a 12-year drunk than some chamomile, you know. And so I wound up going to my room. I was one of like maybe 30 people there that weekend, and I was the only male, I was in a dorm all by myself. All these women are having a great time, and I'm in this dorm angry, and my wife had moved out of the house by then, and everything was falling apart, and she was still trying to be nice to me, and I kept thinking, if you're going to be nice to me, why did you leave, you know, wah, wah, wah. And, yeah, I don't even know why these are up here. Anyway, I promise I wasn't going to cry tonight. So there I was, and we had a guided meditation, and I was sick. I was peeing blood. I was just a mess, physically, mentally, everything. And this is like a last resort. I'm up there, and she brings us into a room, and we lay down on the floor, head to head, like spokes on a wheel. And she takes us through this guided meditation. And you know how this, I mean, if you've been in therapy, you can do it yourself. If you could modulate your voice like that and talk like this all the time, and then everybody would be comfortable and no one would be alarmed. You ever been to an AA meeting where someone's talking like this and you just want to jump up screaming? So she started to do this meditation retreat, and she said, okay, you're walking through a field and you're barefoot, and you feel the wet grass under your feet, and you see a waterfall. So you walk toward the waterfall, and you stand in front of the waterfall, and you can feel the spray coming off of it, the mist coming off into your face, and you feel cool and soothed. And then you step into the waterfall, and the water crashes down on you, and it turns blue, and it takes away all of your sadness. It washes away all your sadness. Then it turns red, and it washes away all of your anger. The water washes it all out. And then it turns green, and the water washes away all of your jealousy and covetousness of other people. And we went through the whole Dunn Edwards catalog. You know, like now it turns Swiss mocha and washes away some damn thing. And while the whole thing's going on, I'm not buying it for a minute. I mean, I'm just laying there thinking, oh, great, what water next, you know? And everybody else is sighing, you know, that self-satisfied sighing of the healthy people, the mentally unchallenged people. And meanwhile, I got a whole burden of the world on my shoulders. And then it was over. And I couldn't get up fast enough. And I'd turn off the pan flute music and we wound up sitting up, and you know, some people are rubbing their eyes, and some are stretching and making that satisfied noise like some dogs do when they're giving that stretch. And I'm just thinking, I gotta get out of here. And she goes, okay, now I'd like you to walk the grounds of the retreat center, La Casa de Maria in Montecito. I want you to walk the grounds for the next 5 hours. I skipped a part. I shouldn't be even telling this story. We washed all the stuff off, and then she said, I want you to look through the waterfall, and on the other side of the waterfall, you can see where you're going to be 5 years from now. And for that moment, I had a moment where I actually saw something. You know, I was actually in the moment for a moment. And I looked through that waterfall, and I saw myself hanging from the belt of my robe from the bathroom door at my mother's house, which is where I live, because that's where most alcoholic men wind up, is their mother's house. And if I have rope in a rehab, I'm going to call it my mother's house, so people won't stay there for a year. You know, get up and get out. You know, she said, "I want you to go around the grounds." And this really shocked me to see that, because I've been sort of detached from the whole thing until she said that, and I couldn't believe it. And then she said, "I want you to go out on the grounds for the next 5 hours. And I want you to think about how you're going to get to that point in your life, you know, hanging from the bathroom door." And I went out on the grounds, and I sat out there for a long time and thought, "I'm just going to finish it right here. I don't want to live. I don't want to live." There was no drama to it. There was none of this to it. It was just a thought like, get me out of here. It's because tomorrow is going to be the same damn day as today, which is the same day as it was yesterday. The same pattern of things I do, the same things I know I have to do, and the same shame, and the same guilt, and the same remorse, and the same regret, and the same restlessness, and the same anger, and the same resentment, and it's all going to just keep going over. It's on a loop. It's just going to go over and over, and I'm 30 years old, and I just don't want to do this anymore. I wish I could just die, and not dramatically, just pluck me out of this world, please. And what happened is, what I was experiencing at that point, I believe, was despair. I'd never experienced despair before, where I thought that there was not going to be any tomorrow. I just didn't want there to be any tomorrow. And what happened was that at that moment, I felt simultaneously a feeling that it wasn't a voice, but it sort of sounded like one that said, "You are everything that you're afraid of, and I still love you." And I didn't know where that came from. And I just couldn't believe it was happening, you know? And so I thought I was going crazy. Went back into the dorm I was in, shook it out the first night while I was detoxing. And then I went home the next day, and it got worse. You think, if I quit drinking, then everything's going to start getting better, which it doesn't. It just gets worse. Detoxing is not easy, and it's not fun, and it's not, you know, it's not like kicking something. It's detoxing not just my body, but my whole perception of the world, that I used to use alcohol to salve that, to relieve that. It was a balm for my emotions. It calmed me down. And now it had become something that I just, because I never took any action on the things that I was supposed to be doing. You know, I've never come out of a blackout with the bills paid, but I went into the blackout thinking I was going to, but I never did it. And the service that alcohol did for me was an illusion. It just allowed me to not have to do things and not feel bad about it and think I was really getting better, you know. And so when I went home and started to detox, and I don't know why I chose to detox, I just said I wanted to die. I didn't say I wanted to detox. You know, that's terrible. And so after about 4 days into it, I was having a real problem. I forgot how to walk at work. I had to sit down on a planter and watch other people going by. I was working at the college bookstore, Santa Monica College, and watching people go by and saying, "Okay, it looks like left foot, right foot." I just couldn't walk. And then I started to feel so isolated. And we talk about loneliness in AA, like everybody thinks it's some kind of a ballad by Brenda Lee. It's not. The loneliness we talk about in AA is that sense that that I can't tell anybody what's happening in my life. I can't blurt it out. I can't say it, because they'll reject me, or they'll laugh at me, or they'll say, "Oh, it's not so bad," or "You're weak. That's your problem, is you're weak." And then they become more powerful than I am, and then they scare me half to death. and I don't want to be around him anymore. And then I drink again because that makes me feel better. And then the cycle starts again. And it's not because I'm addicted to alcohol. I'm not addicted to anything. The problem I have is that alcohol gives me perceptions of a world that I can't handle without it. You know, and I that night when I got after I'd gotten home from that meditation retreat, I was white knuckling it. I was having the shakes. I was having hearing music playing in my car, and the stereo wasn't hooked up, and it was just it was all kinds of stuff going on. And on Thursday of that week, my sister-in-law, my mother-in-law, I'm sorry, called me and said, Debbie's in a care unit in Orange, California, and she needs to get a ride to an AA meeting. Can you take her? And I said, sure, of course I can. I quit drinking myself. I quit drinking this week. I'll take her to the meeting. You know, by all rights, she should have been driving that car, but I was just twitching around. And so I went to pick her up, and she gets in the car. We drove the 20 minutes to the meeting. And in that 20 minutes, she 12-stepped me. And she didn't do it by telling me what I should be doing or what Bill said, because I couldn't care less what Bill said, because I don't know who Bill is. And she just told me how she felt and what she had seen when she was in there. She said the AA people that came in, they were really nice. They were much better than some of the other people we had, because we knew they weren't getting paid to say what they were saying. They just came in there because they were giving up their time. And it was the H&I people. I'm a benefit of the Hospitals and Institutions Committee and didn't even know it. I was like a beneficiary of it three steps down. But because those H&I people came in there and gave the message to Debbie, she was able to give the message to me in her own way, which is the fact that she looked different and she acted different, and it wasn't the same person that I used to drink with. And we got to the meeting place, and she coaxed me to come into the meeting, and I did, and I didn't like it. It looked like a hyper-caffeinated dog park. It was just a mess. It's like people rushing around, shaking hands, handing out cards. You know, their eyes are big, and all the men are coming up to me going, "Hi, my name's Ted." And all I can do is like try to ward them off, because I was looking too good to be sick. I was in the back of the room with I had a Sherlock Holmes hat that I wore all the time, with my sunglasses on, because sometimes I heard it gets really bright in an AA meeting at 9 o'clock at night. And I had long hair, and I was in the back of the room, and I had a tweed jacket that I bought at a thrift store, and I had my wool sweater vest on, and it was the middle of June, and it was about 111 outside, but there I was, hat, hair, sweater vest, shirt, Levi's, boots, standing in the back of the room, trying to look like I know what's going on here, you know. And I couldn't understand why the guys were coming up going, "Are you new?" You know? I thought, no, I'm new. I got 4 days, you know. Because I thought new meant that you were drunk when you crossed the door, you know, the transom. When you walked past that meant that you were new. I had 4 days. I had a lot of experience being sober, I would say, as I twitched around, you know, and they got me a big book, as they do in Orange County. "You got a big book, Charlie?" I thought, I work in a bookstore. How big a book are we talking about? And they took me to the frightening literature lady, who was about six. This lady was 6 feet tall if she was a foot, and she had platinum blonde hair that came down and sprang up at the ends. She wore a starched white cowboy hat. She had a white chiffon top that draped off, and she had a white chiffon pants, and she looked like she'd run through a set of curtains on the way into the meeting. And she brayed when she talked. "Hi, hon!" And I was like, sheesh, you know? And Debbie said, "Well, Charlie needs a big book, you know." I said, "Oh, I don't need a big book, really. I'm not coming back. You know, this is not for me, really. I'm not a joiner, and I'm certainly not joining this." And so the lady said, "Here's a big book." And I thought, "Oh, it doesn't look so big, really. I work in a store." And I didn't say that, though. I said, "Oh." She said, I said, how much is your book? And she said, it's $5. Well, anybody, at that time, $5 was still a good deal on a hardbound book, $5? And I thought, well, $5, it must not be worth anything, you know, for that price. And so I said, and I reached in my pocket and I pulled out three of the most tragic looking dollar bills you've ever seen in your life. They looked as if they had just given up hope. They kind of laid in my hand. And she said, oh, it's the first Sunday of the month, or the second Sunday of the month. They're only $2 tonight, the books on it. And I thought, give me a break. I wasn't born yesterday. And she said, but I didn't say that. And she said, here, I'll take the $2 and the book is yours. You keep the book, read it. If you want to buy one for somebody else, do so. But the book is yours. And that other dollar you've got there? And I go, uh-huh. And she said, when the basket comes around, drop that in the basket because nobody stays sober around here on somebody else's dime. And I thought, okay. When the baskets went around, I didn't know where she was. That dollar bill, I waved that thing in the air and let it go and watched it drift down into the basket, you know. And I left there that night. I heard a speaker. I just had people turn, you know, here's the door, Charlie. You know, there's the coffee over here, you know. And I took her home. We went out for coffee afterward. It's not like we didn't have like 6 quarts of coffee at the meeting. Let's go out for coffee after the meeting. Like nobody thought of it. Like, I haven't had coffee in 20 minutes. Let's go out and have coffee. We go out, we load up and get in the car and drive out to the car, like a place called Spires or something. We go to Spires and we got coffee. There's 14 people around a table made for 10. And everybody's laughing and scratching. They're all talking over themselves. I'm thinking, I got to get out of here. I've got to get out of here. I'm never coming back to this place. I went home that night and I slept. And I went back the next Sunday because AA meets on Sunday. That's what I heard. And I know they met Monday through Saturday also. But I went back and, you know, I went by myself. And I went because Debbie said she was going to take a chip, which nothing could have pleased me more, if you know what I mean. But I just thought, I'll do the kid a favor and come back and watch her take her chip. I'll tell you something. This is just off book, but if one of the greatest spiritual acts you can do in sobriety is learn how to control your eye rolling. If you can control your eye rolling, you are going places. If you can sit and look at somebody while they're talking to you and they're telling you the dumbest crap you have ever heard in your life, and you don't go, oh, you know, I eye roll so hard sometimes I feel like I'm going to fling myself out of the chair. If you can do that, that's a spiritual act. And so I went back the next Sunday, and Debbie got her chip and a hug, a chip and a hug. And she sat down, and she let me hold the chip. Really, should I? And that's how I faced sobriety at the first part. It was like everything was sarcastic. It's like, no, I don't believe in this thing. And then my higher, you know, people would talk about praying to their higher power, and I thought, well, that higher power, anybody here, it's not working for you. It doesn't listen to you. I have experience. That higher power doesn't listen to you, just for your information. I didn't say that, though. I just kind of listened to them. And so she got her chip and a hug, which is what they do down in Orange County. I'd like to do that myself. She said, if you get 30 days, you'll get a chip and a hug, too. And I thought, well, you know, I don't want anybody to touch me. I don't want a hug. You know, I just want you to leave me alone. I want you to help me, but don't touch me. And my friend Eileen W. says she came into AA going, help, you know, help me. And I understood that completely. It's like, I want to be helped, but I want to do it on my terms. And it doesn't work. I found out it doesn't work that way. Because nobody will go along with my terms in AA. Anybody with half a moment of sobriety will go, no, you're going to do it the way I suggested that you do it based on how I did it. And you go, that's not very open-minded. You know, you should be willing to just share it and let me do it halfway. And I didn't say that, though. And so they made me a greeter at this meeting after the third week, which you don't want to meet a greeter like me at the door. Like, Hi, run for your life. These people are crazy, you know. And so the fourth week I heard Chuck Chamberlain. The first 2 months I was sober, I heard Chuck Chamberlain 5 times. And if I'd known what I know now, I would have listened to him. But at the time, I just sat there with my eyes bonking at the top of my head at everything he said about, you know, the carpenter. You know. Which carpenter, Karen or Richard? I mean, I don't know what carpenter he's talking about. And it was just so tedious. And then I'd go up to thank him, because the people made me thank him. They go up to thank the speaker. I go, why do I have to thank the speaker? And he goes, well, he gave up his Sunday night to come out here and speak to us. The least you can do is go up and thank him. All right, huh? Don't think it's so personal about it. And I was the last person in line. And Chuck was, he would thank the last person in line with the same enthusiasm that he thanked the first person in line. And when I got up there, he was really friendly, a sweet guy, lit up a room, and he said, how long are you sober? And I said, 21 days, 22 days. He goes, oh God, I love you. And he threw his arms around my shoulders and he kissed me. Which I'm convinced that's where I caught alcoholism. directly from Chuck Chamberlain, because he was a carrier, boy. And so then we, when I was about 5 weeks sober, a guy named Keith Carpenter came to speak. I can say their names and break their anonymity here because they're dead and they've died sober and they were good members of AA. And Keith, the meeting was in Tustin, California, which is in South Orange County. And Keith lived in the west end of the San Fernando Valley. So he had a good 2-hour drive ahead of him. And when I got up to him, I was the last person in line, and he took 10 minutes to talk to me about my life and what I was doing. And where do you go to meetings? I come here. And he goes, well, where do you go the rest of the week? I don't go to meetings the rest of the week. I live in West LA. I live in Santa Monica. And I was living at my mom's house in Anaheim, working in Santa Monica. So I can't, I don't have time to get to a meeting during the week, which goes over really well with old timers. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, let me give you my phone number, and this is the address of the Wednesday night meeting that I go to, and why don't you come to that meeting, and I'll look for you. I said, okay, so I went to that meeting that Wednesday night. I left work and went to that meeting, and it was about 350 people in this room, and they were all happy. They all seemed happy, and I wasn't happy. And I wasn't really doing anything. I didn't have a sponsor. And people suggested I get a sponsor. Suggested in the way that they go, do you have a sponsor yet? That's their suggestion. And you go, no. But the thing about it, I got a sponsor not because I wanted a sponsor, but I wanted them to shut up, basically. You know, they said, do you have a sponsor yet? I go, yeah, that guy right there. That's who it is. Go talk to him, you know. It's like he was my attorney in AA, you know. And so he said, when I asked him, he sat me down in a coffee shop and he said, are you willing to do anything to stay sober? And I said, yes. And he goes, good, that's great, that's great. What I want you to do, first of all, I'm going to give you some direction on things I want you to do that are real specific things. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. I want you to get to a meeting every day. Okay. I want you to call me every day. Okay. I want you to get a commitment at your meetings where you do something to help the meeting. You might mop, you might change the toilet paper in the bathrooms. You might clean the mirrors. You might make the, we make pride ourselves on leaving a place better than we found it. So you'll get a commitment to do that. You might get here early and do setup or stay late and do cleanup, but go up and just ask them for a commitment. And you go, I said, well, what commitment do I ask them for? He goes, you don't ask them for any commitment. You just say, I'll take anything you want me to do. And then you do it. I said, well, how long do I have to do it? And he goes, what's a year? I thought, but I kept my mouth shut and did not roll my eyes at that point. And he said, I want you to go out for coffee with people after the meeting. I do not want to see you in your seat before they hit the gavel, because I want you out and around shaking people's hands, looking them in the eye, and asking them how they are. And oh man, I'm going to tell you something. You ever have a little kid, you raise kids, and you try to get a little kid to go into a store they don't want to go into, and they just do dead weight in your hand, and they hang and they just twist in the wind like this and whine And I don't know how they twist 360 degrees, but I didn't check, but that's how I was with everything he was telling me. And you got to shake hands with all these people. Oh God, shake hands with people. That's horrible. And he goes, and ask them how their day was. You know? And then I want you to, when the phone numbers the men give you, I want you to call at least one of them every day and ask them how they are. Oh, you know. And then he said, one more thing. I'll see you at the meeting on Friday at the men's stag. By that time, why don't you shave that mustache off and get yourself a haircut before you come to the meeting? And I thought, you know what? Okay, let's just get real here. I've looked at your book, and there is no chapter to the barber in here. Okay? I don't know what that, I didn't say that, but I just looked at him, and he goes, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, why would I ask you to do something like that? And he said, you just said 30 seconds ago you were willing to do anything to stay sober. I said, yeah. And he said, I just asked you to shave your mustache off. If you're not willing to do that simply because I asked you to do it, what makes me think you're going to do the steps when I start asking you to do them? I just want to find out if you're a loser or not as soon as possible. So I guess I'll see you Friday. He got up and walked out. You know, and I was stunned. I thought, what kind of a cult is this? You know, as I found out later, the only cult that tells you, quit giving us money, go back to your families, you know, be responsible, join society, you know. And so I said, okay. And I went home and I didn't want to fight it. I didn't want to fight one more thing or else I'd drink again. So I shaved that mustache off and went back to the meeting. And he was so happy to see me. And he said, here we go, sport. And we walked through 26 years together in this fellowship. And he walked me, I went back to grad school because he told me to. I did all my commitments. I mopped floors. I was a great mopper. That's what the Irish are built for anyway. So I was a good mopper, and I folded the cords for the anal retentive sound guy on Saturday night. They had to be folded just a certain way. And I carried literature in for the literature guy because he had a bad back. And I picked up guys and took them to meetings and cleaned coffee pots because I wasn't sober long enough to make coffee, you know, all the stuff they have you do, you know. And there were so many people at our meeting that they had so many commitments that people wanted. Sometimes you just get the coffee pot where you dump the grounds. Somebody else washes the pot. So somebody brings it back there and sets it down. You take the grounds out and dump them while somebody else takes the pot and cleans it. And then somebody else washes the basket you gave them with the grounds that used to be in it. Everybody had a little job to do, and it was like an ant farm. It was really great watching everybody doing the stuff. And I did that for months. And I finally, you know, I thought, what are we going to do the steps? I'll start doing the steps. You know, I hear everybody else talking about it. And I went to Bill. I said, when am I going to have a spiritual, you know, a spiritual thing? Because I hear other people talking about it. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, when am I going to have a spiritual awakening or a moment? He said, do I look like a psychic? I have no idea when you're going to have your spiritual awakening. Just keep doing what you're, because I was 8 months sober. I was convinced AA didn't work, you know, completely oblivious to the obvious. But I said, hey, I've been here doing this for 8 months and it doesn't work. And Bill said, just keep doing it and see what happens, and it'll happen for you. And I said, how will I know? He goes, you will know. You will not mistake it for anything else. You've got to trust me on this. Trust you on this. Like, I've been cleaning coffee pots. Like, look at my hands. They're all cracked and everything. And I continue to do what I was doing. And I just thought, I keep hearing people get up to the podium and go, yeah, I'm 7 months sober today, but I haven't been to a meeting in 6.5 months. But I came back today and I had a spiritual awakening. You haven't done a thing in here. You just walked in after being around for 6.5 months, gone, and you had a spiritual awakening while I've been here mopping the floors, cleaning the pots, driving the newcomers, bolting the anal retentive guys' cords, doing all the stuff that I have had to do, and nothing happens for me. And she walks in here, and 30 seconds later, she's God's BFF. What is going on here? You know? And about 2 weeks after I told Bill I wanted to start doing the steps, he Well, actually, he took me to one side and he said, "You're going to meetings, right?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "And you're doing your commitments because I see you." "Yeah." "And are you calling guys?" "Yeah." "You're getting phone numbers." I bought the book at the drugstore, just like you told me. I put everybody's phone number in here, so I call them. "Good, good. You call the man. And you're calling me because I get your phone call in the morning. And you seem to be doing things great. You seem to be doing fine. What part of the first three steps do you think you're not doing? Is there a lot more than a ritual? AA is not a ritual. Sport." That's what he used to call me. "Sport." I said, "Well, what about getting on our knees and doing the third step?" He goes, "No, I don't do that." What about you reading the big book to me? "Read? Do you know how to read?" "Yeah." "Read it." "What do you want me to do? Hold your hand? You want a brownie? Come on, I'm not going to read it to you. Go to the book study on Tuesday night, every Tuesday night, for the next indefinite amount of time, and sit there with alcoholics reading the book, and then listen to how the book applies to how they're living their lives. It's not meant to be a history book that you study for dates and times and study facts so that you can barf them out to somebody else. It is a guidepost for the way you live your life. And what you're doing, what I've asked you to do, is to do the steps. And what happened was, about 2 weeks later, I was mopping the floors at Ohio Avenue in West Los Angeles, and I stood there looking at the people lined up to thank the speaker, and it occurred to me that I knew every single one of them by name, and I liked them. And I don't like people. How does that happen? I didn't want to be anywhere else but standing there with that mop as I looked at those people. And I called Bill that night, like 2 in the morning I called him, and said, I told him what happened, and he said, "You just had a moment of grace." He said, "I'm really happy that happened. That's exactly what I told you you were going to have." I said, "Well, what does it all mean?" Because I was raised Catholic. I know what grace is. He goes, "What it means is that you finally got out. You did enough to get out of your own way and allow God to come out and play." And I've never forgotten that. And it's always reminded me that the power that I believe in, and you can believe in the higher power. Any higher power you want is your higher power. We're not going to tell you what it is. You can pray here, pray to this. That you can pray to anything, really, and make it your higher power. That's fine. What I believe, though, is that higher power resides inside of me. It lives in me. And that doesn't mean that I'm God. What it means is that it allows me, if I want to see it in you. And it will never allow me to see it in me. I'll never see that higher power for myself. But if I live my life right, maybe somebody else will see it in me and it'll give them some hope. But I never will hope. I'll never be sitting down after a day and have a cosmic hand pat me on the back and go, "Good job, son." Ever. It's not going to happen that way. But I can go out in the day and say, "Look at that beautiful lady crossing the street here. I hope God is good to her today," and somebody says something kind to her to let her know that she's loved. I just think that. And I realize after I drive away, I don't know that person, but I could see the higher power in them. I could just believe that it's there and pray for them. And it's not a big complicated thing. It's not a big thing. I didn't have to have a third step that struck me with lightning. It was an awareness of the way things were changing around me because I was doing the steps. And I did my fourth and fifth and all the other steps I'm not going to take you through because I don't have a chalkboard I can use to write all the information. But my life got better. I went back to grad school. I got a job teaching at the college where I was loading books. The students would have me in the morning. They would walk by in the afternoon, and I would be jumping up and down in the dumpster, smashing the books boxes down so we could compact them. And my students would walk by and go, is that Mr. Carney up there?" Yeah, I'd wave to him. "How you doing?" I was happy as could be. I'm sober. I'm working. Somebody hired me to do this job, and I didn't even believe I could do it. And I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't had my sponsor, all figuratively grab me by the collar and go, "Say yes," you know. And I did. I taught for 7 years. And then at the end of after I signed a contract, I wound up teaching high school after the second year, because apparently the pain of teaching college wasn't sufficient. And I taught high school for 7 years. And And my life got progressively better, and I was always involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never backed away, and I've always stayed. And I think that's what's kept me in. It kept me okay. And I got an opportunity to write, which I wanted to be a writer. One time I was at a meeting, and there was a famous writer who was in my group. And I knew him, and his name was Maurice Zolotow. And Maurice wrote a lot of biographies and stuff, and Reader's Digest stuff. And he was talking to some other writers about writing. So I kind of sashayed up, you know, and well, listen in because I'm going to be a writer. I've got a tweed jacket. And he looked over at me. He was a big, imperious guy. He turned over and looked at me. He's from New York, really New York. He goes, yes. I said, I'm just listening. I want to be a writer. And he goes, well, then write something. And he turned back around and kept talking to these people. And just really, it was like, wow, you know. But it was the best advice I ever got. Because while I was teaching, I was writing with my kids too. I had them write, I would write. And then I wound up getting an opportunity to write for a living. And this is what happens in AA. If you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, you're doing it here and you don't know, and life's going on, it's moving along. You don't know what the opportunity that's coming from way over here that might be moving up on you. And when you intersect paths with that, at least my experience is, I hope I've been practicing. Because when the opportunity hits, I want to be able to take it and not go, oh, wait a minute, I got to backtrack, and start over. I'm there. My life is good, you know, and I wound up getting married twice, and I'll quit quickly. I don't just quit. I used to have a sponsor named Bob Regan who lives in Oxnard. He's 50, almost 57 years sober, and he has saved my life over the past 15 years for a lot of things. But I had two children by my second marriage. And I wound up raising them full time. The courts gave me full custody of them, and that was a hard, you know, it was hard. But I remarried, and she was a great stepmother to my children, a very excellent person, and AA has provided me again. I've been retired for 7 years, but now I'm going to start work next month. As a substitute teacher at the Ventura Unified School District. So be careful, people. And my life is still better. I'm involved with somebody now who's just a delightful, sober lady. And we have a great time together. We laugh all the time. And it's terrific. But I'll tell you something, especially to new people, Alcoholics Anonymous works. It works as long as I'm doing it. It works when I get the job of my dreams, which I have, and it works when that job goes away. And it works when I fall in love and I'm in a relationship that I care about, and it works when that love goes away. And it works when I'm cutting my children's umbilical cords at 50 and amazed and marveling at what's happened in my life. And it also works when I'm doing CPR on my son who's overdosed in his bedroom. Alcoholics Anonymous works. I just have to be in the middle of it so that when the world starts spinning around really fast, I'm not hanging off the edges and just fly away and nobody even notices I'm gone. I get in the middle of it so when my world starts to spin around and spin around faster, out of my control, I bump into a lot of you and you save me. And you wash away the pain, and you bring me some hope, and keeps me moving. So thanks for having me. Thanks, Lee.
I'd like to thank Charlie C. again.